our worship has been the last number of weeks, haven't you just appreciated just the song selection, the depth of the words, the lyrics? One of the reasons I love this church is because those on the platform are not putting on a show. We're not here to display talent. What we're here to do is worship the Lord, and you've got people up here who have got humble hearts that are leading us in worship. My thanks to Everett and Sarah for selecting songs, for Kelly for putting together worship order, Hannah for writing the readings. They just do just a great job. And by the way, there is reasons that we have you appreciated Meekness and Majesty, learning that new hymn? Just an incredible hymn. And it's just written just a number of years ago. And so there's people writing good stuff today that's rich in lyrics. I hope that in your bulletin that you have been reading the meditations of the week each week. This week was on John Newton. We do extensive research on that and put that in for your edification. And the reason we sang Amazing Grace was because it was written by John Newton, a former captain of a slave ship. And you can read some information there in your bulletin on both the lower left panel and the upper right panel that will just be a blessing to your soul. Well, this morning, this is the last of three installments that I have themed Meekness and Majesty based on the miracle working of Jesus. Next week, I'm very excited for the next three weeks in a row, we will be dealing with a series that I'm titling Facing the Giants, 3 weeks on the battle between David and Goliath. You will learn more about the battle of David and Goliath than you ever have cared to learn. You'll understand why they were fighting. You probably don't know the answer to that today. Why were they having a battle? Why was Saul hesitant? What did David do? Why did he show up, of all things? How was he able to slay the giant? Why was it that if Goliath wins, we have to serve you, but if David wins, we will serve you? How does that work? And so we're going to be taking 3 weeks in a row, again, looking at archaeology, maps, historical background, geography. There are reasons geography comes into play on that story, and you'll discover why. So I hope that you're going to be able to be with us the next 3 weeks in a row before we begin our Christmas series. You won't want to miss it. This morning, we're going to be dealing with John chapter 2, the changing of water into wine. And once again, we're just going to do a lot of background into this. John, when he wrote his gospel, did so with a reason. He tells us the reason at the end of his gospel twice. He says in John chapter 20, as well as in John chapter 21, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples. If everyone were written down, not even the whole world could hold the books that could be written. But these have been written that you may know that Jesus is the Christ, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John clearly gives the reason for his gospel, that you might understand that Jesus is God and that you might believe. So what he does, he selects seven and he calls them signs. He doesn't call them miracles, he calls them signs. Now, they are miracles. The Bible talks about signs and wonders. But he uses this interesting word, signs. Why would he do that? Why would John select the word signs? What's a sign do? It points. It points a particular direction. I've said this before, but if Jesus did three miracles a day, and he did far more than that, but if he did three miracles a day, how many miracles would he do in a single year? Over 1,000. How many years did Jesus minister on the face of the earth? 3 years. That's over 3,000 miracles. That's just three a day. If he did more than that, Jesus probably did 5,000 to 10,000 miracles when he walked this earth. Had you ever thought about that? John selects seven. In the Gospel of John, he selects seven signs. Now, obviously, he could have chosen over 3,000 to 4,000. Why these particular seven? Some of them are found nowhere else in the Bible, such as turning water into wine, the healing of the nobleman's son, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. It's only found in John's Gospels. And so John was very selective on what he chose to include in his gospel. And using the law of first usage, which means anytime an event, a word, a particular action happens in the Bible, the first time it happens is of special significance. So when John's going through and he selects seven signs, guess what's number one? Changing water into wine. There's reasons for that. And we'll unpack that this morning. Thank you, Cam, for reading the passage for us this morning. I'd like to reread it. Get out your pen. We're going to interact with the text together. I'm going to mention several phrases that are particular key and crucial that I want you to give consideration to. Here we go. On the third day, circle third day. Why was it on the third day? We'll discover that in a moment. And what day of the week was that, by the way? Do you have any idea? What's the first day of the week? Sunday. What's the second day of the week? Monday. What's the third day of the week? Do you know anybody who gets married on Tuesday? Jews do. And you'll find out why. In fact, a close friend of ours, our second guide in Israel, when we went to Israel, Brian Schultz is his name. He works at Fresno State University now teaching Hebrew. Brilliant young man, has his PhD in archaeology. He got married on Tuesday purposely, third day of the week. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana of Galilee, or Cana in Galilee. Would you underline that phrase, please? We'll explain that again in a moment. Jesus' mother was there. Circle the word there. John is telling us that for a reason. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Have you ever seen that verse before? Can you imagine? Our three boys have been married. The last one got married 2 years ago, and coming up with a wedding list, who do you include and who do you exclude? Who's going to make the cut on the wedding invitation list? Isn't it interesting? Jesus made the cut. Jesus and his disciples were invited. There is something of value when you invite Jesus into your marriage. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother, of all things, taking responsibility, said to him, "They have no more wine." Dear woman, why do you involve me? He wasn't asking that because he was pestered. He was asking that to cause her to give consideration to what she was doing. Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." Again, if you look at the very last verse, this was his first miracle. Jesus didn't want the boulder to begin rolling down the mountain and picking up speed and momentum too quickly. That's why when he does this miracle, nobody knows what's going on behind the scenes of the miracle, except if you drop down, verse 9, the servants. Nobody else knows. He purposely does that because he doesn't want to gain premature momentum. That happened, and they tried to make him king, and he had to slip out between them. Verse 5, his mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Pretty good advice, by the way. Nearby stood, watch the use of the numbers and the details John gives. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Why does John give those details? Because he's proving he's an eyewitness. I was there. I saw them. There were not five. There were six. Each held 20 to 30 gallons. We'll talk about those in just a moment. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. Watch. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Hey, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink," which was apparently at that point of the party. "But you've saved the best until last." Underline that phrase. It's a biblical principle. He saves the best until last. This, now John gives his own commentary, the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and the disciples put their faith in him. Once again, why are they getting married on Tuesday? By the way, when do people around here get married? Saturday, usually, or maybe on a Friday night, perhaps on a Sunday. Nobody gets married on Tuesday. Why do Jews get married? Well, why do we get married on Saturday? Because it's a discretionary day. It's the weekend. You got all week to get ready, and then the wedding's on Friday or Saturday. Why don't Jews get married on Saturday? It's the Sabbath. Can't work on the Sabbath. See? Can't work on the Sabbath. By the way, isn't it interesting? Jewish holy day is Saturday. When is the Christian holy day? Sunday. When is the Muslim holy day? Friday. So you've got you're down to a four-day work week in Israel because you've got all three cultures in there. You go into the old city and you walk through the old city on Friday, you've got to be careful when you walk through the Muslim quarter. On Saturday, if you walk through the Jewish quarter, all the shops are closed. And on Sunday, the Christian quarter. And so you got different people taking days off during the week. Interesting culture. So they get married on Tuesday because you can't work on Saturday. So that keeps them, the preparation is now limited to Sunday and Monday. Remember, getting ready for a wedding, you've got feast, food, wine, all the stuff that you got to do, but you can't work on Saturday. So you've got to do that on Sunday and Monday so the wedding can be on Tuesday. That's the reason they do it. The Bible also tells us, notice you've circled the word Jesus' mother was there. The construction of the original Greek indicates that she was there for a purpose, that she was there because she was normally there. The fact that she would try to solve the problem, not the master of the banquet, would indicate that she was probably in charge. But it's a male-dominated culture. So she couldn't be the master of the banquet, so what she's doing, she's working behind the scenes because she's in charge. That's why she goes to Jesus. The other thing that you've got to understand is that one of the highest values in the Middle East is hospitality. This idea of, and we'll talk about it more when we get into the Christmas season, but this idea that Jesus went to an inn and it was full and the innkeeper said, "Sorry, you can't come in," that didn't happen. You would never do that in the Middle East. Innkeeper's never mentioned in the Bible. And chances are, when the word inn is referring to a section of the house, and so we've tended to make a mythology about some things that aren't there. And so the whole idea of running out of food, you look at the number of times in the Bible that people get together for food. I mean, what do we do? How did Jesus want us to celebrate his life and do this in remembrance of me? Shoot off fireworks? No. It was a meal. It's of high value in the Middle Eastern culture. Whenever we go into shops, particularly Jewish shops in the old city, they will automatically bring out tea and juice. I thought, wow, these are really friendly people. Until we drank their juice or drank their tea and said, "I don't think we see anything we're interested in." He goes, "And here we gave you juice and tea." And they understand that they can use guilt and shame with Americans. And so the first time we were there was right after 9/11, and the State Department said, "Americans don't go to the Middle East," and we went anyway. And it was wonderful because there were no lines anywhere. fact, when we were in Egypt, they had two police cars and four policemen follow us everywhere we went in Egypt for our own protection. The last thing they wanted was an international incident with Americans. And so what they would do, they would leverage, they would give you, out of hospitality, they would give you tea and juice to make you feel guilty about buying something there. And so that's why people told us, look as Canadian as you can. Don't wear anything with words on it. Isn't it interesting? No mention is made of Joseph. Why not? Most scholars believe Joseph was probably dead at this time. We do know that at the age of 12, when Jesus got lost for 3 days and his parents couldn't find him, and remember they found him in the temple, the Bible says he was 12 years old, so Joseph was alive when Jesus was 12. We also know that Jesus began his public ministry at the age of 30. So somewhere in those 18 years, Joseph has passed away. In Jewish culture, when the husband, the dad, passes away, who's now the man in the house and who takes responsibility? Answer, the oldest son. And so if Joseph passes away when Jesus is 18, 19, 20, it's merely conjecture and a guess. Jesus being the firstborn, how do I know Jesus was the firstborn in the family? Mary was a virgin. So he had to be the firstborn. So the firstborn son, probably at the age of 18, perhaps 19, now takes over. He's the head of the home, and for the next, until he's 30, 10 or 12 years, Jesus is now working in, it's not, the word is not carpenter, that's the English word that we use. It's a, the word is construction worker, probably in stone. Just outside of Nazareth, there's a town called Sepphoris, and during this time, there was a major construction project during Jesus' boyhood that most probably construction workers would work on in this place called Sepphoris, just outside of Nazareth. It's very likely that Joseph and Jesus were workers in stone and concrete at the Sepphoris project. It's just outside of Nazareth. So Joseph isn't around. The Bible tells us that this happened in Cana of Galilee. There is a second Cana in central Israel in the area of Samaria, and that's referred to as Cana of Samaria. So John is trying to delineate between these two geographical places. So he, again, as I mentioned last week, he uses the reference Cana of Galilee. Just to give you an impression once again of where we are. Last week we talked about Bethsaida right here on our map. Do you see Cana on the map? It's over here. Down here is the Jezreel Valley. That's what this says right here. It's off the screen, the Jezreel Valley. Jezreel Valley is very, very famous because what will eventually occur in the Jezreel Valley? Battle of Armageddon. The town of Megiddo is over in this area here, Megiddo, where we get the word Armageddon. This is where you can look over the Jezreel Valley today, and it says in the book of Revelation, the blood will flow as high as the horse's bridles. It also says that God will bring his judgment with the hornet. And if you're looking into the Jezreel Valley right now, you know what you see? An Israeli Air Force base. And guess what's taking off and landing on the Israeli Air Force base? F-15 Hornets. Down here, from Capernaum, this was California Road Missionary Church, over to Cana, what would this be? University Park Mall, remember last week? So here's the UP Mall. And then down here is Nazareth. Right there, it's just a short jaunt right there. This would be Bethel University, right down here. Cana, by the way, do you remember which disciple was from Cana? Of the 12, one of them was Cana. His name was Nathanael. This is the guy that when Jesus shows up in John 1, and Peter says to him, or Andrew, "We have found the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth." And what did Nathanael say? "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Why would he say that? Because he was from Cana, which was a little podunk town, and Nazareth was a little podunk town. By the way, you know how big Nazareth was? We'll talk about this in a few months. 300 people. The size of the California Road Missionary Church property. So, Nathanael is from Cana. Jesus' boyhood home is in Nazareth. We have found the Messiah, and this guy says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Some scholars believe that's the reason Jesus did the changing of water into wine at Cana, to indicate to the local boy, Nathanael, "You want to know something? Something good did come out of Nazareth, and something good will also come out of Cana." My first miracle. This is, Kate, let me back up just for a second. From Cana, this is the Beth Netofa Valley right here. From Cana, right now, they have an interstate going from Cana to Tiberias. That's the interstate right there. I'm standing with my back to the Sea of Galilee, which is just a few miles away. I'm looking, you can see Upper Galilee over there where the hills are. Beth Netofa Valley right here. This is the interstate. This is the modern town of Cana in Galilee. Guess what you're going to find in that town today? You're going to find what's known as the Franciscan Wedding Church. Guess what happens there regularly? Yeah. One of the most popular places in the world to be married, and now you know why. Not only that, it's one of the most popular places in the world to renew your wedding vows. See? And so these people are probably tourists. Locals probably wouldn't do that. They're probably tourists, and what they're doing, that they're renewing their wedding vows. You can tell that maybe they're Jewish, although they're not wearing kippahs or yarmulkes. And Jewish people probably wouldn't be there renewing a wedding vow based upon a New Testament passage. So not only is Cana today, it's a big place for tourists to go, for people who go back to visit in Israel, pilgrims returning to the Holy Land. What else would it be popular for? Makes sense, doesn't it? So tourists who go to Cana today, you will buy wine. Again, because of the story. And so it's a very popular location today, not only to renew your wedding vows, but also you can, by the way, find this on Amazon and save yourself the cost of going to the Holy Land. This is the Israeli Museum that's found in Jerusalem. We've been there several times. These are original water pots. Guess how many gallons they hold? 20 to 30 gallons. Some of these were actually found in Cana back in the actual period of time. They're about knee. They're bigger than you think. They're about knee to waist high. By the way, those big drums that people use to burn stuff in, those are 55-gallon drums. So this would be about half the size of a 55-gallon drum. They use to store water. They will use skins. They will use bladders and stomachs of animals. They will use fish hides, fish skins. But they'll typically also use water pots like this. And with this, they will do ceremonial washing. Why would they do that? Well, because if you're Jewish, back in those days, you're washing all the time. You're washing your feet. Jesus talks about the foot washing. You're washing your hands. By law, you had to wash at least three times a day. Jewish men had to step in and completely submerge in like a bathtub Those are called mikvahs, and they're all over Jerusalem. Everywhere you see is a mikvah. And people, you had to walk down the steps completely submerged, but you couldn't walk up the steps that you just came down because you would defile yourself. Because when you walked down, you were dirty. So you would walk down these steps, you dip in the mikvah, and then you walk over it, and then there's a second pair of steps that you would walk up to keep yourself ceremonially clean. They would have these in homes, and they would also have a mikvah because, again, they're doing ceremonial washing all the time. So when Jesus changed water into wine, they figured this out. 6 water pots, 20 to 30 gallons, so you're talking about at least 120 to 180 gallons of water changed into wine. People have done the statistics that 750 bottles of wine, 750 bottles of wine he just created, and this is the good stuff. So not only had the guests already had plenty to drink, Jesus now brings out 750 bottles of wine, and here it is. Is it any wonder the master of the banquet said, "Whoa, man, you've really saved the good stuff for last." And there was more than enough, just like in the feeding of the 5,000. Lessons from the miracle, I'd like to suggest 3 this morning, and here's the first. Again, using the law of first usage, why did John select this miracle? John is sending us a message. There's something of significance regarding this miracle. And because this was the first of his miracles and the first of John's 7 signs, he's sending a message. Pay attention to this one, because this is indicative of what you should know about Jesus' miracle-working power in your life. I think that's what John's telling us. Take a look at this miracle, because this one sets the standard on how miracles will happen, how Jesus will work in your life. And the first is this, and it makes complete sense. Miracles, John tells us, occurs in the context of believing prayer. Did you see anybody pray in this particular story? Well, what is prayer? Talking to Jesus. Bringing your needs to Jesus. And who does that? Mary does that. Mary sees this need, feels the responsibility, goes to Jesus and verbalizes the need. They've run out of wine. This is embarrassing in our culture. We can't do this. They're out. Isn't it interesting that Mary doesn't suggest what he should do? You know what, Jesus? Why don't you just turn all this water into wine? She never, by the way, that never entered her mind to tell him to do that. She had no idea what he was going to do. Isn't it funny how you and I, we will bring our needs to the Lord, but sometimes we also dictate the terms. This is what we need, and by the way, this is how you have to do it and when. Mary, being his mother, but also a believer in her son, she had to make this transition from he's my son to he's my savior, had enough sense to realize if I bring the need to him, I need to step back and let him do what he wants to do. Can you and I do that? I need to bring the need to him and then step away. Miracles occur in the context of believing prayer. You see, there were 3 issues that come to bear, and you may want to write these words down under this number 1. First of all, she had to believe he could do it. Write down the word believe. She had to believe he could do it. Secondly, she had to care. She could believe he could do it, but she could say, look, it's not my kid getting married. She had to believe, can he do it? And secondly, I got to care enough to go to him. But then the third word I want you to write down is the word trust. Because then she had to trust him that he was going to do the right thing, in the right way, at the right time. Now, you've probably never considered this before, but do you know the difference between the word believe and the word trust? Two different words you just wrote down. Believe means, I know he can do it. Trust means, I'm going to wait for him to do it. I know, not only do I think he can, trust is, I think he will. That's a different issue. Because right now you're wrestling with an issue in your life, and if I ask you, do you believe he can solve this problem, you would readily say yes. Trust is a different deal. Now you can trust him to do it. I don't know about that. And by the way, I'm right there with you. We've got issues going on in our lives, our personal lives, and our family, our immediate family. Do I believe that Jesus is up for the task? Yes. Now, am I going to trust him? No. Maybe. Sometimes. Good days, bad days. See? That's the difference between belief and trust. I think most of the time, the belief part, I'm okay on. Where I tend to stumble is on the trust issue. Isn't it interesting? Mary was good on all three of these things. I care enough to fix the problem. I'm going to take it to Jesus because I can't fix it. And then I'm just going to step aside, not knowing what he's going to do. And by the way, you need to do that with the issue you're dealing with in your family. Am I willing to bring it to the Lord in prayer? And then step aside and say, I don't know how he's going to solve it, but I know he will. That may be your growing edge today. This is the first issue. Issue number two. Miracles occur in the context of willing obedience. Now, where am I getting that? I want you to drop down to verse 5. His mother says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. In other words, she is establishing the benchmark. You've got to obey. You've got to do what he says. Look in verse 7. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. What's the next phrase say? So they filled them to the brim. That's an obedience issue. Drop down to verse 8. He gives a double command. Draw some out, take it to the master of the banquet. Those are two different issues. What's John write at the end of verse 8? They did so. So they respond to three different commands. Fill the jars with water, dip some out, take it to the banquet. The Bible says they did it, they did it, they did it, and boom, a miracle happened. And so I've got to recognize in my life, I have got to be willing to do what he says. If you and I are not willing to do what he says, he is not obligated to work on our behalf. I need to obey him because this is what happens. Obedience yields eventual results. The critical word in that sentence is the adjective. Eventual. Because you might say, you know what? I've been praying. I've been trying to do the right thing. I've been trying to obey. I've been trying to be faithful. I've been coming to church. I've been serving you, Lord. Man, and you're still not... Well, that's because now it's into a timing issue. Obedience yields eventual results. What I also found intriguing in the story is this issue right here. Those who serve and obey Jesus, they will see the hand of the Lord working in ways that other people can't see. Isn't it interesting that the Bible says, Master of the banquet had no idea where the wine had come from, but then he says, however, the servants did. Did you see that detail? Apparently, servants see and understand things that other people don't. As I continue to serve the Lord sometimes will pull back the curtain and allow me to see His hand. Unbelievers or those who are not walking with the Lord, they'll just say, wow, that worked out. I remember when that school bus runs into my truck. End up fixing the truck for $40 myself. Insurance company of the bus company gives me $500 to cover my deductible, which I never turned in. So this accident that looked horrible, I mean, busted out my left turn signal on my pickup truck and scratches it and lifts up the bumper. It was over $1,000 worth of damage. I fix it myself for $40, get a check for $500. Colleagues at school, this is their response. You were lucky. Nah, luck had nothing to do with it. What that was God taking that which seemed like a negative in my life, turning it into a positive, and He blessed Judy and me. When you serve the Lord, you see things and understand God's hand sometimes in ways that others can't. And finally, number three, miracles occur in the context of Christ's timing. We've already alluded to that. Notice John immediately tells us in verse 1, it was on the third day. What John is doing, he's setting the stage for his reader saying, notice timing issues. I'm beginning with the issue of time. It was the third day. Down in verse 4, what is Jesus' response to Mary? My time has not yet come. Jesus surfaces the issue of time. And then in verse 10, one of the other people who speaks in the miracle, the master of the banquet, says, everyone brings out the choice wine first. You've saved the best until now. Those are timetable issues. By the way wine is made in the world, it's made from water. Because what happens, the skies rain water, it waters the vineyard, the vine, in a vineyard, the grape plants, they draw the water up into their stems, goes to the leaves, it begins creating fruit. The grapes that are created by the vine, they get big, plump, and juicy. Where does that water come from? Well, it comes from the water that they've drawn up through the soil, which has come from the sky. And then those grapes are crushed, fermented, and it turns into wine. So basically, the way you make wine is it's water eventually turns into wine. But what Jesus does in this particular miracle is He accelerates the process. Turning water into wine isn't particularly miraculous. You know, wineries do it all the time. They just don't do it instantaneously. And so what you see in this miracle is that the Lord accelerating the process. He does the same thing in healing. Sometimes medication will take a long time before people are healed. But sometimes Jesus can do it instantaneously. And so a lot of miracles are just simply the speeding up, the acceleration of the process. Jesus has the ability to do that. How you and I want Him to accelerate the process in the issue you're facing. Save my daughter now. Bail out my marriage now. Change my husband now. Speak to the heart of our son and our grandkids now. I'm discovering more and more my doctor's telling me I've got arthritis in my hip. I've got arthritis in my hands. Put my fingers together, you can see they don't match. This morning I woke up and had so much pain in my hands, I can only bend my fingers this far. I can't bring them all the way. Falling apart. So I took some Tylenol this morning, got online. What's the best thing to do about when you have arthritis in your hands and hip and sometimes my brain? Tylenol sometimes helps. Okay, I'll take some Tylenol this morning before I go to church. Could Jesus heal that? Of course he could. Will he heal it? I don't know. Because there's sometimes times that he chooses not to teach us lessons. Three times Paul prayed, take away this thorn in my side. Three times God goes, no. And so finally it dawns on Paul, oh, I see, you're not taking away this thorn in my side so I can discover dimensions of grace. That your grace is sufficient. Maybe part of the reason he's not answering your prayer is that you might discover dimensions of grace you've never known before. And by the way, you will not learn those any other way. Sometimes it's through pain. Incidentally, I hate that rule, but I think it's biblical. Isn't it interesting? Chris Gibson, the gentleman in the wheelchair that comes, he's a part of our church family. He's unable to be here today. He got his new wheels. I mean, he went from a Corvette to a Lamborghini. Remember, what Kobe said this thing would cost retail? $25,000. $25,000. And so we as a church, remember, we surfaced the issue, and the church leadership says, you know, we want to participate and do something that we, and so we prayed about it. Remember, we were up here kneeling, we were praying for it. We took the issue, look at your note outline, we took the issue to the Lord in prayer. Why did we do that? Because issue number two is that we care about Chris. And we said, Lord, here's the need. We need this wheelchair. We want to help. We have no idea what you're going to do. And $25,000 isn't sitting around for Chris or for us. And so we step out of the way like Mary did. And suddenly Kobe tells that story last week of this family in Dallas that has this wheelchair because she passed away. And they're giving it to the church for a tenth of the price, $2,500. He turned water into wine, didn't he? And those who serve the Lord, the curtain's pulled back and we see things that other people don't. How God is able to meet needs and do miracles. Boy, Chris was lucky. Has nothing to do with luck. We just simply went to the Lord and said, hey, here's the issue. I don't know what you're going to do, but here's our need. And you saw, we as a church saw firsthand, collectively, the hand of the Lord work and do a miracle. He was unable to be here this morning. He and his mother were going to come because we want to, maybe next Sunday, we want to dedicate the wheelchair, lay hands on Chris. What a testimony to his mother. I guess my question for you is, where is this story tangent for you this morning? What issue are you wrestling with? It's not an issue that you haven't prayed about it. He just hasn't answered yet. It's not an issue that you're not, that you don't believe. The issue is whether you trust. I'm going to ask you to bow your head with me as I pray. Father, forgive us for not noting your miraculous hand when it's so actively at work. Just this issue of Chris and this wheelchair. Lord, what a thrill for those of us in this church to step back and watch. And Lord, for the generosity of this church that has given enough money to cover the $2,500. This is over and above their tithe. People are willing to reach into their pocket, contribute, and it's paid for. And this young man is the beneficiary not only of the generosity of a church and of a family in Texas, but the generosity of a good God. And Lord, may that bolster our faith that whatever it is that we're facing in our own families, that we'll continue to be faithful in prayer, we'll continue to obey, and then we'll step aside and just wait to see what you're going to do, and it's probably something beyond our wildest expectations. And beloved, while your heads are bowed and your eyes are closed, I'm going to give you just a few moments of quiet to offer to Him again the issue or issues that you're wrestling with this morning. Amen and amen. I'm going to invite our worship team to come as we conclude our service shortly.